Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The 2018 wading bird nesting season was one of the largest on record, and that's according to the annual South Florida Wading Bird Report by the South Florida Water Management District. It was prepared along with Audubon Florida. Between December 2017 and July 2018, there were nearly 140,000 wading bird nests in South Florida, and about 122,000 of those were in the Everglades. This was by far the largest number of nests found in the Everglades in decades, and biologists say it compares to some of the largest nesting events ever recorded back in the early 1930s. Nesting activity for birds like the roseate spoonbill, wood stork, and white ibis far exceeded their averages for the past 10 years. For the rest of the hour, we're going to listen back to a conversation we had earlier this year, just after that report was released, with Dr. Sean Clem. She's the research director for Audubon Florida at Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary, and Brad Cornell, who is Big Cypress Ecosystem Policy Associate with Audubon of the Western Everglades. Let's hear that now. So, Dr. Clem, what kind of birds are we talking about here exactly? We say wading birds, but what does that encompass?
Well, what we saw last year was an increase in all of the wading birds throughout the system. Every species saw numbers that we haven't seen in a long time. The most notable of that last year was the white ibis, who nested in numbers that were, you know, five times the 10-year average. They were just had, just a really banner year.
So these are, you got white ibis, mm-hmm. the great white heron. I mean, who all is in here in this category?
White ibis, glossy ibis, American egrets or great egrets, wood storks, roseate spoonbills. Those are the snowy egrets.
Okay. Yeah,
and then some of the, you know, those are all the kind of light colored birds that you would most easily see.
Would cattle birds be considered that?
Cattle egrets as well.
Little, with the little yellow feet, the ones that are curious about everything.
Yep.
So that's quite a number of birds, but this does not encompass things like ducks.
No, this would be just your long-legged wading birds.
Long-legged guys, not the shore guys. So what does it mean when we say that these wading birds are indicator species?
Well, it means that they have specific, you know, ecological or biological requirements that when their population is doing well, it says really positive things about their ecosystem.
That means they have things to eat.
They have things to eat. They have habitat. You know, they have places to nest. They have, you know, they're able to catch the food they need. They're able to build the nests that they need. They have all the resources that they need.
So they had declined for years because of a lack of one of these items?
They had declined for years because of originally because of plume hunting. And then following that, because of the hydrologic change in the Everglades with the compartmentalization and the, you know, building of all the canals throughout the Everglades system, just kind of taking that contiguous system and breaking it up into pieces and beginning to drain it is really what disrupted their ecology.
Brad, I'm going to turn to you now and ask you, the disruption occurred, the populations continued to decline, and now we're seeing numbers coming back. Has the situation gotten better on the ground, or the wet ground, I should say, or have they adapted and become able to work around it?
Well, it's a little bit more of the latter. This is an issue that remains, the loss of habitat. We've destroyed through drainage and development more than half of the original Everglades. And that is really, as Dr. Clem just pointed out, is the reason that we don't have more than 90% of the wading birds that we used to have back in the 19th century. So to get those birds back or some proportion of them, we've got to restore those wetlands. What happened last year was really a huge amount of rain fell. And so the birds took the cues from all this water, which grew a ton of fish, and they said, "Ooh, let's whoop it up. We're gonna make nests because this is not something we usually see."
And so a singular rainy season can have an impact.
Yeah. Yeah,
rather than
exactly.
A full trend.
Exactly. And that was just – it was just demonstrated for everybody. And this was no small singular event. This was a huge rain event. Dr. Clem can share more
Of
the
details. By one season can alter their nesting.
It's not going to – so to be clear, the Everglades have not been completely restored. They haven't – we've only begun, frankly, you know, which is a little bit of a bad on us. We need to be further down that road of Everglades restoration. Mother Nature just threw us a nice softball and gave us a whole bunch of water, which is one of the main objectives of Everglades restoration. Let's get more water into the system. Mm-hmm. She just dumped it on us whether we were ready for it or not, and the result was the birds noticed. And so what we would like to do with Everglades restoration is to more purposefully and more consistently create as much of the original Everglades as we can that would allow that much water to come into the system. And the birds, now we have just seen demonstrated for us, the birds will respond apparently.
So you said something earlier a minute ago that in the 1800s, I think is what you said, there were 90% more birds. We are looking at now 10% of the number of wading birds we had.
Right. The numbers that Audubon has, you know, Audubon got started trying to protect these Everglades wading birds. It was really kind of the story of our existence. But when you go back over 100 years ago, we have accounts in people's diaries, naturalists, who said there were 100,000 wood storks at Corkscrew alone, 100,000 wood storks. Now there's, you know, we just had 140,000 nests in the Everglades, but there were probably 2.5 million wading birds throughout all of the Everglades in those days over 100 years ago. So that's a huge number of birds. So when they said they would darken the skies, you can believe it.
That would be a lot of birds. Could we handle that now if we had that many birds?
We don't have the space, unfortunately. We'll take all the birds we can get because people come from all around the world to look at these birds. They spend good money to go see, you know, little blue herons and great egrets and the great blue heron and roseate spoonbills.
A big spot for birders.
Yeah.
This is definitely a starting point.
Fun stuff. And if you're not excited by seeing a beautiful bird with its egrets all out in display for breeding season, then you must be asleep.
Yeah, you're sleeping through something, definitely. How do you figure out these numbers? Dr. Clem, Brad, who could answer that? How do you – because the Everglades are kind of hard to, you know, get into and see. Do you take a snapshot of a given spot and based on the terrain would imagine that it would duplicate across, or how do you figure that out?
Yeah, this is a huge multi-agency effort that was done by, you know, Audubon had several different places throughout the state that, you know, we did some surveys, South Florida Water Management District, federal and state agencies, some county governments were involved, and universities like Florida Atlantic University and University of Florida. So it was a tremendous number of researchers whose energy and work went into getting these numbers. And the methods really vary a little bit depending on what the habitat is. You can't survey birds in the same way in, you know, 80 to 100-foot cypress trees at Corkscrew like you could in mangroves in the middle of Florida Bay or out in the middle of the, you know, central part of the Everglades. So methods are a little bit different. They range from on-the-ground surveys, sometimes crawling into mangroves and using a mirror and a long pole to look into the nests, especially down in, you know, the spoonbill nests down in Florida Bay. At Corkscrew, we do aerial surveys. So we're flying over and using aerial photography to get images of those birds. There was a big effort this year to use drones to try to look at some of the supercolonies.
I was going to ask about drones.
And because those white ibis super colonies this past year were just so tremendous, it took, you know, an unbelievable amount of effort with drones flying day after day after day to really be able to get images that you could, you know, put back together and try to get a really realistic picture of what's going on up there.
Well, I'm just kind of trying to think of this. And if I go to a pet store and I look at a cage full of finches, I have a hard time counting up to 12. I mean, it's because they move, you know.
Right.
How do you become certain? Is it because you get a still photography, a slice of time, and can count from there?
In some cases, yes. And in some places that works. In some places you're using other methods. You're just flying over with, you know, two observers who are actively counting, and then you put your numbers together and, you know, see how you did.
Yeah, average out.
Right. It really just depends on, you know, the resources your research
you're working with
has, or, you know, the habitat itself or the species that you're dealing with.
Have you personally gone out and counted?
I have. I've done the woodstork flights at Corkscrew a few times. We've got a great team that does them most of the time, but I do get a chance to get out there sometimes.
So do you end up having volunteers that you train to go out and help do this, or are they usually agency paid personnel that handle this?
I can only speak for what we do, and we have no lack of staff that want to get up there. So we usually get biologists and interns. We have in the past been able to get volunteers up there, but usually our staff are chomping at the bit to have, you know, an opportunity to see something like that from the air.
Brad, have you gone out and done these counts?
I have not. I have heard that it's a little bit nauseating when the planes do their transects back and forth.
Oh.
And I've heard that reporters like yourself have been up there and have lost their lunch. So I'm not super jumping at the bit as much as the biologists are, but sometime I'd like to do that.
It depends on how you are. I've always said that I've had a gut of steel, so I can handle all that stuff. So
okay,
well, I'll go up next time. I would love to. That would be fun.
I'll have to work especially, on getting up there.
Well, it'd be fun to go. I mean, where do you find – are there certain places where you can find certain birds? You're talking about the wood storks and corkscrew.
Right.
Is that kind of where they hang out? And then you said spoonbills down south?
Right. So there's a lot of known colony locations. You know, the corkscrew colony, of course, historically was the largest wood stork nesting colony in the U.S. And so that's been, you know, a target of our monthly surveys during the nesting season since the late 1950s and 1960s. Other known colonies, you know, the spoonbill colonies down in Florida Bay, are, you know, known islands where the spoonbills will nest. Some of the work in the Everglades, birds will return to known popular nesting locations year after year. But then you also, depending on, you know, environmental conditions that year or restoration actions, you can have new colonies that pop up as well. So there's some systematic work that's done to try to detect new colonies, but then you're also, you know, looking for those known colony locations as well.
So let's talk about some numbers. Which species saw the biggest nesting increase in this past year?
That would, I think, for sure be the white ibis.
White ibis. And who came in second?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
I'm just curious because I want to know. I mean, and can this be an anomaly or can this be a trend? I mean, is there any way to know? Do these guys trend? Because it sounds like they respond to seasonal weather events too.
Well, I think it's an encouraging... I think it's an anomaly in some ways because we really saw that tremendous rainfall in 2017. We, on average, get about 60 inches of rain throughout the year in southwest Florida. And at Corkscrew in 2017, we recorded 60 inches of rain just in June, July, August. Throughout the whole year, we got closer to 100 inches of rain.
So we
had tremendous rainfall.
In 2017, we were kind of cursing the rain a little too, though. You know, because we had a lot of outflows from Lake Okeechobee, which filled up, and we ended up after. Well, okay, 17 we had the hurricane, and then after that, we still had all that water that needed to drain out, and the harmful algal blooms and things like that. So, do we have this? Is maybe like one ray of sunshine after the hurricane?
Well, I think that cursing the rain is a huge part of some of the problem here, because when we have these flood events, our first instinct is we need to get this water off the land. You know, we need to get it out of our cities, we need to get it, you know, off of our roadways, and we really actively and we work very hard to get the water out to the estuaries when we have those flooding events because it affects our way of life and because we don't have the water storage capacity inland that we used to have because we've destroyed so many wetlands. And the result of that we see is all that water getting flushed out to the estuaries, you know, the nutrients from the landscape getting carried on with it, which feeds things like red tide.
I think that's the part we were cursing more so than just actual rain itself. But,
then in the long term, you're also seeing, you know, then you get to the dry season and all of that water that was supposed to have soaked down into the ground has been lost because we flushed it out to the estuaries. And then we have these big fires that come up.
Yeah.
So it puts us really into the cycle of flood and fire because we don't have good capacity to store the water.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Dr. Sean Clem. She's a research director for Audubon Florida at Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary, and Brad Cornell. He's Big Cypress Ecosystem Policy Associate with Audubon of Western Everglades. We're talking about a recent report about last year's wading bird nesting season in South Florida. It was a banner year with numbers not seen since the 30s. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. I understand that there was a particularly huge super colony near I-75 in western Broward County.
Yeah, I think that is the Tamiami West colony.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a colony that's a year after year a good performer. And it just is one of those ones that just had a really fantastic year
this
past year.
Banner year.
Yeah.
So the conditions that wading birds are looking for generally is water to wade in and the fish that live there. How quickly do the fish respond after these giant rain events?
The fish respond extremely quickly. You know, the fish that live are native to the Everglades are, you know, evolved to be in a very difficult environment. So as soon as water levels come up, they disperse and they begin to reproduce and grow. Mm-hmm. Because their goal is to produce, you know, their offspring before the dry season comes again. So, you know, little tiny mosquito fish can disperse and move miles just in a very short time because they're just really, in tune with this changing environment. And they need to survive. They really are tough animals.
I've never heard of a mosquito fish.
Yeah, they're often used for mosquito control because they have little upturned mouths and they eat things towards
larva?
The surface like mosquito larvae. So they'll actually – a lot of mosquito controlled districts will give them to you to put in rain barrels and koi ponds because they're good at eating little bugs like mosquito larvae.
I think I need some of those in my neighborhood. That would be great.
Don't we all?
What about salinity? Are these birds choosy about the salt situation or freshwater? Do they care?
trying to think exactly the best way to answer that. The historically, most of the wading birds would nest in the estuarine areas of Everglades National Park. The majority of Everglades wading birds would nest down there. In more recent years, they've been nesting more in freshwater parts of the Everglades because the estuaries haven't been receiving enough water.
They're not quite as balanced.
And there's too much salt down there, so they've moved north. So by restoring, you know, the freshwater flows in the Everglades, we can push those birds back down south into the estuaries where they want to be.
We have a call coming in from Louise in Naples who has a question or two. Louise, what would you like to ask?
I think part of this was already answered. Unfortunately, I thought I had this really clever question. Well, this is not exactly it, but I'm leading up to it. You know, I remember being here in 2015 when it was an extremely wet year, and I'm surprised to hear, admittedly, I'm in Naples and you're out there in Corkscrew. I'm very surprised to hear that 2017 was a wetter year than 2015, and I don't remember hearing anything about a great nesting season then, but, you know, maybe I just wasn't plugged in. That was one comment. Then where the heck do these nesting birds come from that you say we've experienced in the last year? I'm delighted, incidentally, but where do they come from if the previous nesting results were not that great? I guess what you just said makes sense. They come from elsewhere? You know, somebody sends out the word, holy Toledo, all that water down there. Come on, let's go. This is where we're headed. And then the last thing is, last year was a really good year. We don't know what this year is going to be like. What if this and future 2-3 years are low water years? What happens to all those birds now in existence after the boom year of this past year? Where do they go? What do they do?
Louise, those are really great questions. How is the communication system with birds to send out the all points bulletin that there's a lot of water here and they can come back to this area?
Right. So these birds naturally move throughout the system and they have a seasonal move through the system. They tend to be, really active in the Everglades during the nesting time. And then other parts of the year, a lot of the species, especially things like wood storks, will go farther north in the system. So I think that's a really important point that when we had this really good year in 2018, those birds didn't just, you know, magically appear from the sky. They came from somewhere. So what those birds told us is that they would rather be in that really wet Everglades environment than anywhere else. So they've come from up north, primarily from other parts of the state, and they're kind of aggregating in the Everglades because that's where they want to be. That's where they were historically. That's where the habitat is and food is best for them. And if we put enough water there, that's where they want to be.
That's where the cool birds hang out.
Right.
But the other question then that she asked was Louise, I'm going to paraphrase you here, but you asked about if we had this big boom in nesting, where do these birds go if they come back next year and find that it's dry? And how do they find their way to a wet spot?
Right. And they will come back next year. And we know that about their ecology. And I can tell you a little bit about what happened this year, not only, you know, at Corkscrew, but in other parts of the system, is we had a setup for another pretty good year and water levels started to fall as we went from, you know, October, November, December into January. And then we started getting rain in the wet season, which is bad news for wading birds. And the water levels came back up. And what that does is it takes all those fish that were you know, aggregated for the wading birds to be able to eat, and it spreads them back out over the landscape, which makes it really hard for them to catch enough fish to survive and to feed their chicks. So what we saw this year was the wood storks and the other wading birds began to nest throughout the whole system in December, and water levels came up and they abandoned nesting. Oh. And we have no wood stork nesting, you know, at Corkscrew this year because of that. They started nesting, but then they just left because the food resources were so stressed.
Because the fish were dissipated throughout because of all the water.
But I think it's important to note that, you know, these are long-lived birds, and their natural ecology is such that they'll have a really good year and then they'll have a really bad year. And sometimes a really bad year is followed by a really good year.
Okay. So how long do they live?
Gosh. I want to say wood storks live on the order of 20 years or so.
Well, that's longer than I thought. All right. Louise, does that answer your questions?
Wonderful to have those guests. You specifically are super. I always think that whenever I hear you. And lovely guest this time, and such a thought-provoking discussion. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Louise. I have to thank also our producer and all the other people that work on this show. It's not just me. They just make me look good. And Louise, I'll be sending you a check soon. I'm just joking. Anyway, so I want to ask a little bit about how efforts to restore the Everglades, how do these efforts fit into the equation of trying to make a consistent, nice home for these birds to nest in, Brad?
Well, Julie, I think that's kind of the real big question for all of us. Because if we want to see this kind of response on a more regular basis, we recognize that nature has ups and downs. But in order to consistently get wading birds and the Everglades to respond most years or more than we've had in the last 50, we've got to build Everglades restoration. And that means creating storage. That means creating ways to clean water through wetlands. Wetlands are nature's kidneys, and we've lost so many of them that the water actually is running off the landscape full of all kinds of nutrients and pollution.
It's like a filter, basically.
Yeah, they're called filter marshes, right. That's an artificial way to do it, but restoring wetlands is the nature's way to do it. Both of those are needed. Storage is needed because we can't hold our water anymore. We're leaking all over the place. As Dr. Clem just pointed out, you know, when the rainy season comes and we're flooded, let's say East Bonita Springs, and it's flooding, everybody's yards are underwater, everybody says, get this water out of here. But then you don't have it in the wintertime when you really need it for water supply, for flood, for fire protection. So the system's not working for anybody. We've got to build storage and water quality treatment. And that's what Everglades – it's the biggest wetland restoration project in the world. We've got to find funding and get the Army Corps and the Water Management District on the ball every year at a large capacity and a fast pace.
I understand that you were at the open door meeting with Representative Francis Rooney, who was in town talking about harmful algal blooms. And I heard from our reporter who was covering that you came with a lot of solutions and had identified dollars that could be championed for by our representative. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the ideas that you brought to that meeting? Because I'd like to hear them myself too.
Sure. Everglades restoration, biggest wetland restoration project in the world, as I said, costs a lot of money. We're talking billions of dollars, which maybe in some corners of the federal budget doesn't sound like a whole lot, $20 billion, $15 billion. But it's hard to muster for wetlands. So there are programs that the federal government has that really are designed for this kind of stuff. There's one called the Land and Water Conservation Fund that was just reauthorized last fall by Congress that has something like $900 million every year that comes from Gulf oil and gas drilling royalties. It's basically mitigation for all the damage that drilling in the Gulf does. That's supposed to be used to buy National Wildlife Refuge and wetlands. And there's one called 150,000-acre one called the Everglades Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge. We've only bought about 10,000 acres. We need to buy a whole lot more of that because that's how you store water, keeping those wetlands wet.
And efforts like that can be championed by
– Absolutely. It's a federal program. But it doesn't work if Congress doesn't put the money in the budget for that. So that was one of my suggestions to Congressman Rooney, was put that money in that budget for buying Everglades Headwaters.
And you have a source for it too.
Yeah, it's already there. It comes every year, $900 million. There's also the Farm Bill, which has conservation programs that actually pay people to restore their wetlands. We need that kind of restoration all over the landscape. That's what we're missing. We need those back. And that helps. It's not the solution, but it does help with harmful algal blooms.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Sean Clem, Research Director for Audubon Florida at Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. Dr. Clem, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And I also want to thank Brad Cornell, Big Cypress Ecosystem Policy Associate with Audubon of Western Everglades. Brad, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for coming to the show.
Thank you.
And thanks to my earlier guest, Dr. Lisa Corte, Sanctuary Director at the Audubon Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.